It's the Philosopher's Zone. And have you ever listened to yourself? It just might reveal something.
Usually what you find is if you observe yourself, it feels a little bit spooky because what you're realizing is that actually you don't really know what you're going to say until you've said it.
Something quite big, in fact, about free will. That huge area that touches on all the major questions. Responsibility, blame, identity, the fate of the universe. Well, maybe. But free will is under attack, unravelling as each new scientific fact stacks up. Not all are convinced, like Julian Baggini, who's ventured to the front line to take back some territory for what's come to be known as compatibilism. I hosted Julian Baggini at a packed event at the Sydney Writers' Festival.
Thanks very much. I'd normally stand up to talk, but I fear that if I do, I'm going to wander and that people who have chosen their seat in order to avoid the sight lines of the pillars will be annoyed. So I'm going to remain seated, which is an interesting point in itself because we discover in all sorts of ways that how we think is actually obviously deeply connected with our bodies in various ways. Whether you're sitting or standing, moving, relaxing, whatever, it makes a difference. We are embodied through and through. And that's a bit of common sense in a way, but it leads us potentially to troubling questions. And in fact, you know, the very problems around free will perhaps start with that recognition that human beings are, in an important sense, fully part of the natural world. And there's nothing about us which can kind of exist in independence from that. Now to put straightforwardly, that view can be misdescribed. All it really means is that if you were to take all the stuff of which you are made, the only stuff you'd find is physical stuff. It would all be the kind of stuff described in physics. Now, you can see that is true. It doesn't necessarily follow from that that things like, you know, love and happiness and meaning and purpose, which are not categories of physics, it's not to say they're not real, but there is this sort of difficult philosophical problem. If such things are real, how do they then relate to this fundamental physical substrate of everything? That's kind of a little background to where the problem of free will comes from. The problem we have for free will is that there seems to be lots of reasons for thinking we don't have it. And the view which I'm defending is part of a long tradition. So the basic position I defend is not completely new and original to me. It's an idea called compatibilism. Now, compatibilism says that all these things which science tells us about how we are fully a part of the natural world, as subject to the laws of nature, as everything else, all of that is entirely compatible with the idea that we have free will. Sometimes it seems as though it's not compatible, but really it is. Now, a lot of people look very dimly on that view because they think that in order to sort of say that free will is compatible with this, the version of free will we put forward, which as Joe said is perhaps not what we assumed with, is just some watered down, fuzzy, non-free will. We're missing the subject. And, you know, I want to make it a bit difficult for myself in a way. So what I want to do just to begin with is to set out why it is that it seems from a kind of materialist point of view we can't have free will. And to do that, we first have to say, well, what is free will? What do we mean by free will? I think there are certain key features that people might assume having a free will means. The first is that what we do is in an important sense because of what we think and what we believe and what we desire and so forth. If our thoughts and our beliefs and our desires and our decisions actually aren't making any difference to what we actually do, we can't possibly have free will. The second factor is that at any given point, it must be true that we could have done otherwise. And actually, that definition, could have done otherwise, is often taken to be the central, you know, axiomatic definition of free will. So you were looking at the program, whatever it was, or you were just wandering by, whatever it was, and you saw this event was on, and you made a choice to come here. But to say that was a free choice meant that at the time you made that decision, it must have been the case that you could have equally have said, no, I won't go. I'm going to go to that other event, which we won't mention elsewhere, okay? So this seems to be the two sort of key pillars of free will. Now, why is it then the scientific worldview seems to challenge that? The reason this is around a lot at the moment, I think, is that, you know, we've got this fancy new kit called MRI scans and CT scans. And, you know, we can map the brain in ways that we couldn't do before. And one of the most famous set of experiments was done by a guy called Benjamin Libet. The basic principles in all of these is that you wire someone up and you ask them to do something. It can be arbitrary. It can be just a sort of like make a decision in their head, or it could be to push a button, point, whatever it might be. And there are very clever ways in which these experimenters can get the person to notice the time on a very, very fast moving clock that they made that decision. And then you compare the timing of their decision, when in their conscious mind they said, yep, going to do it, with what's been going on in their brain. And what's found is when you look at the brain activity, you find that several milliseconds, and in some of the most stunning experiments say several seconds actually, before the person was consciously aware of making a choice, the brain was already, as it were, gearing up to do what it was they decided to do. So this seems to be very, very strong evidence that actually this conscious decision-making isn't, as it were, the thing that's pulling the trigger on the action. The trigger's been pulled in the brain unconsciously before you were aware of it. And that, to a lot of people, is almost proof, actually. Some people say this proves free will is an illusion. Now, there are various ways you might try and get around this. Obviously, with any experiment, there are people who will challenge the method of the experiment, claim that it wasn't quite done in the right way. And in fact, there are reasons for suggesting some of these experiments are somewhat imperfect. Just the very condition of it. The condition is extremely unnatural. I mean, this isn't really testing what happens when you're deciding whether to come to this event or a different one or not, because they can't follow you around with a scanner on your head all the time. So it's a very artificial situation which you're asked to do something completely arbitrary. So in that sense, it might not be at all representative of what's actually going on. But actually, I'm not going to argue with the basic finding, because I don't want to be a hostage to fortune on this. There is this sort of big tradition in free will, which is to sort of like think that when the science seems to impinge on it, what you do is you find the gap in the science, which hasn't yet, you know, closed, and you put free will in there. So any defense of free will, I would say, has to acknowledge the fact that a lot of what we do in our daily life, the decisions we make, there's stuff we're unaware of in the brain which is generating it, and the conscious mind is not always sitting there controlling things, right? If we can't make that compatible with free will is an illusion. Okay. Now, a lot of the neuroscience, people get very excited about it, but I think the fundamental problem way predates it. If you look through the history of thought, whenever people have concluded that human beings are fully a part of nature, subject to the same laws as anything else in nature, they've always ended up worrying that that will mean we don't have free will. Because it would seem that, you know, that view entails that everything we do is ultimately a consequence of what's happening at the level of the physical atoms which make up our bodies and our brains, and everything else is kind of irrelevant. So, you know, Laplace had this great thought experiment where he talked about this, you know, Laplace's demon, it's sometimes called. At the time, he believed in like the Newtonian universe where everything worked like clockwork. And he thought if you knew all the laws of physics and you knew the position of everything in the universe at any given point, if you had sufficient intellect, which of course no human could, you could then predict everything that happened in the future and everything that happened in the past, because everything was just the unfolding of natural laws. And again, people say, well, if that's true, it seems there's no room for free will, because whatever you do, you are bound to do it. Okay. And again, the point is, it's worth saying that the quantum complication doesn't really get us out of that, because if you're not strictly bound to do it, but the only thing which means you could go either way is some random, unpredictable event in your brain, that doesn't seem to give you free will either. So I want to step back and think, okay, so all of this, all of these arguments do depend upon us not having free will, on the assumption that free will has those characteristics I mentioned before, that free will somehow must involve the ability to do otherwise than you do, and it must be the conscious choice which is leading you to do what you do. Now, if we're going to challenge that, I think it's quite helpful to step back and think, okay, let's look at examples of what we take to be, you know, paradigmatic examples of people expressing their human freedom. I looked at creativity, artistic creativity, and I also looked at political dissidents. Well, let's look at political dissidents first. I think these are the great heroes of freedom. People who are political dissidents win awards where terms like freedom and liberty are often in the title, or either the award or the organization given to them. We really admire people who stand up and make that choice. And so if there's any example we've got of a human behavior which expresses human freedom, I think it's standing up to tyranny, putting your own life at risk to do so. Interestingly, when you talk to people who have done that and you ask them why they did it, a lot of them will say something like, I could do no other, I had no choice, right? They don't experience the choice in terms of, I could have done this, I could have done that. Equally, I just went to do that. Because if you did experience it as that choice, why on earth would you be a dissident? You got one choice, right? You put your own life at risk and the lives of your family at risk, or you walk away and you gain your freedom and you gain your life. If to you, you could equally choose those two options, why on earth would anyone not do the other? Now, when people make those choices, it's because they feel compelled in some way. It feels like they can't not do it. When it comes to things that are of most value and importance in our life, we don't experience them as things in which we could just as easily say yes or no. All the things that most matter to us, we feel some kind of compulsion, I think, to do one thing or another. Or we're in a situation where the very struggle we have is that we don't have that compulsion. We're torn in two directions, right? And when we're torn in two directions, it's very interesting. We don't experience that as a freedom, right? If you go and see your therapist or something, or a close confidant, and you say, I'm really struggling, you know, I don't know whether to stick with my relationship or walk out on it, I really don't know what to do. It'd be very odd if they turned around and said, well, that's fantastic, because actually, this is brilliant. This is a paradigmatical case of free will, because you could do either, and it's just your choice. Oh, God, no, you don't want that. And it's certainly not just a choice. Same thing goes with like religious commitments or non-religious commitments, moral commitments, and again, also with relationships, right? You know, there's an important sense in which you have to make lots of choices when it comes to personal relationships. They are important, but, you know, whether or not you really truly love someone or not is not something that is a simple choice, you know. It, again, if you was to say, someone says, you know, will you marry me? And you say, well, you know, I could say yes, but I could equally marry him or her. I'll go for you. No. So actually, you look at our experience in life and you think, this whole idea that free will is fundamentally the capacity to have done otherwise doesn't tally with what we feel about the most important decisions in our life, right? But so what do we feel? What does matter there? What does matter in all these cases is not that you could have done otherwise, but as it were, your choice is something that you are making yourself, that it flows from your values, the values which you, in some sense, have no choice but to ultimately accept. But, you know, you're not doing it under coercion. No one's forcing you to do it. That's the first thing. You have thought about it. You're not just doing it automatically and unthinkingly. I think when you find that if you just do things because that's the way you've always done them and you've never thought about it, that's not a good example of a kind of a free choice. So it's the choices flowing from you. They're your own. So in a sense, you own your choices. But I would suggest that the idea that owning your choices requires you to be the original and sole author of those choices is actually crazy. There's no way anybody or anything could be the sole author of their preferences and their desires and their personality. You might say not even God could be that. And I mean that quite seriously, and there are theologians who would agree. If God is meant to be all free, all powerful, God can do what he wants. But you know, there's a theological puzzle. If God can do what he wants, could he not decide that thou shalt commit adultery and thou shalt murder? Could he, you know, could he decide to be evil? Could he decide that what we call good is evil and vice versa? Well, a lot of theologians say absolutely not. That's not what God's freedom means. Freedom doesn't mean the capacity to do anything. It means, in the case of God, the capacity to him to act solely according to his own nature as the supreme good and not in any other way. That's the freedom to be himself, if you like, to have that integrity. And I would suggest that's a similar position in which we find ourselves. We're born, we have, you know, we're formed by our genes to a certain extent, we can't deny that, and we're formed by our society, by our upbringing. We're not the ultimate authors of who we are, but we take ownership of who we are, and we act from who we are, and that's the best and the only kind of freedom that we can have. Okay, let me just say a little bit more about the artist. So what I've really discussed there is put emphasis on the idea that this could have done otherwise thought, although it very intuitively appealing, perhaps is wrong and misguided, and we need to get rid of it. And like I said at the beginning, you know, the sort of dizziness of this debate is that I follow the argument I'm giving now, and I think that's got to be right. But there does seem to be something compelling about that idea that surely you're not free unless you could have done otherwise. The surely, I think, needs contesting. Now, the other aspect of it is this: the extent to which freedom requires that our decisions are the product of conscious choice, the things going on in our conscious mind. And this is where I think looking at the experience of artistic creativity is a useful challenge. Because, you know, you talk to the vast majority of creative people, and sure, they do have to make conscious choices about what they do all the time. But the wellsprings of creativity, the ideas, where they come from, all of that is almost always reported as something which people find utterly mysterious. It's in the unconscious mind. In fact, sometimes it seems to be so much from without the person that people believe it comes directly from God or from the heavens, you know. People talk about, some songwriters talk about how they don't feel they're writing songs, it's rather they're kind of catching them, you know. They're like all songs, everything. It pops into their head and they go, oh, God, that one, and they've got to write it down and put it out into the world as soon as possible. Writers are very much like this as well. You know, I mean, Ray Bradbury writes about this very well, and it's like as he's writing, as he's typing, it's like he's like following his characters around the room, seeing what they're going to do next. He's as excited as you are when you're reading it. And it sounds funny because, why does it sound funny? Because somehow we've internalized as common sense the idea that, of course, if you create something, you're in charge. Well, not in that moment-by-moment way. And again, we may not all be great creative artists, but the basic insight there is something I think we can relate to our own experience. And the simplest one is just talking. And observe yourself while you're talking. And I'm trying to do this to myself now, and you can see automatically it brings this kind of like tension. I begin to stumble a bit over my words because that's not what we normally do. We normally just speak. And if you observe yourself just speaking, saying, you know, what a completely brilliant talk, or, you know, what a complete waste of a morning, I never get that hour back, whatever it is, usually what you find is if you observe yourself, it feels a little bit spooky because what you're realizing is that actually you don't really know what you're going to say until you've said it, right? You know? I mean, roughly you might do, and sometimes, yeah, it depends on the situation. Sometimes we very deliberately plan what we're going to say, you know, like, I love you, you know, I love you, I love you. Would you like a cup of coffee? You know, that's the way it comes out. But, you know, that's not the norm. It's not the norm. The normal way we speak is we speak, and the speaking is spontaneous, and we don't sit inside consciously writing a little script for ourselves and then saying it out loud. It just comes out. So you do this, you start noticing this, and that's a bit weird, actually, because, you know, I thought I was in control of my speaking, but actually, where is this me which is controlling it? It's just coming out. Oh my God, wow, wow, wow. I don't think it should be too weird. Observe your own experience, and you'll realize this whole idea of the conscious controller from moment to moment, it's ridiculous. We ever thought that was the case. Of course it isn't the case. Right? Now, the conscious mind has a role to play. It does. But the role it has to play is not in that kind of moment-to-moment directing of what we do or what we say. It's more of a kind of, it's a kind of a monitor. We monitor what we do. We are aware of our own awareness. And that's the thing which makes us distinctively human. All animals are conscious. We're pretty sure of that. But we're self-conscious, we're aware of our own awareness. And that gives us certain capacities to reflect upon what we do and why we do it, and to question it, and to change ourselves accordingly. Now, I think it's in that capacity, that self-monitoring capacity, and the ability to feed back to ourselves, that we get our sense of freedom. And that is actually what meaningful freedom consists in, no more and no less. And a lot of these sort of evidence that we have no free will is based on debunking the idea we should never have had in the first place, which is that we're in constant conscious control of all we do. That's just a load of old nonsense. So to sum up, people say we have no free will because they say it's not true that we're in conscious control of all that we do. And a lot of the time, if not all of the time, whatever we choose to do at any given moment is inevitable given the point we have there reached. And I would say both those things are true, but that doesn't mean we don't have free will. Because the kind of free will which would be counter to those things is a kind of a magical kind of gift or property which you can't actually make sense of. The ability to make a choice unconstrained by anything, from nowhere, from nothing, that's not kind of freedom. That's kind of, it would be a kind of capacity to have a random decision generator. And that wouldn't be meaningful. Meaningful choices emerge from who we are, from our values, and they're free to the extent that we've been able to reflect on them and take ownership of them and take responsibility from them and so forth. And that's it. Now, you know, I think the last word should go to Daniel Dennett, who has written the second best book on free will available. It might be the best, actually. It's called Elbow Room. It's a very, very good book. He's written a second book on free will called Freedom Evolves, but I think the earlier one is better. But, you know, as the way he sums it up is that, you know, free will may not be the supercalifragilisticexpialidocious thing you thought it was, but it exists. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Clear thinking with optimism, though not unrealistic, Julian Baggini at this year's Sydney Writers Festival. And there was a spirited Q&A session after his talk.
What are your thoughts on the implications for the justice system and responsibility and blame and punishment?
Very good question. Two extremes on this debate, which should be avoided. There's a certain kind of conservative way of thinking which dismisses any attempt to kind of see social, biological factors as influencing criminality as just letting people off the hook, you know, and that, you know, people know what they're doing and they should be punished accordingly, and bleeding heart liberals who are talking about poverty and stuff, the causes of crime, are not just wrong, they're insulting all the honest, good, poor people who grew up in poverty and never committed a crime in their life. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that there's just loads of evidence that's just not true. We know that social background makes a huge difference to criminality and so forth, and upbringing makes a huge difference. But in certain crime areas, it's heartbreakingly obvious, you know. So that's not true. Now, but if you go to the other end, and, you know, the kind of extreme sort of Marxist determinist kind of way of thinking, which is that everyone is purely a product of their society, and maybe, well, they may not say the genes, and that therefore, in a sense, there's no responsibility whatsoever. Well, that can't work either. And why can't that work? And I think the answer is because you have to understand responsibility as being, again, found in the middle. It's something we're never absolutely responsible for who we are and what we do. But except in some very rare cases of some very particular sort of neuropathologies, we're never completely unresponsible either. Responsibility is something we have to build in ourselves and in other citizens and in children. And the way you build it is partly by having systems of praise and blame and punishment and reward. Now, that's not just kind of acting as though we had free will in order to have a good result, which is what it's sometimes accused of being. It's actually the fact that in order for us to gain a certain degree of control over our own behavior, we need to be responded to in that way. The more we treat ourselves and others as creatures who have no choice, the less control we actually do take over our behaviours, the more we just go along with things. So responsibility, I think it's just not true that people either have it or they don't have it. It's something that we have to build in ourselves and others. And you can't build it by simply saying everything's in the genes and everything's in nature.
Really interesting, Julian.
Thank you.
I've got a question about the artistic creativity. Unfortunately, I can't remember the person's name. He's an Englishman. He had a television series. And I recall watching a YouTube clip of him bringing some creatives in to create a logo for a company. they taxied to the destination, and unbeknownst to them, they pass a number of things on their way destination. He then gives them a brief, and so he is directing them slightly, I suppose. He already has some drawings that he's made that fit the brief, which he places in the room, but they can't look at them. At the end of the session, they show him their drawings.
Yeah.
And they are very, very similar to what he created.
Yeah.
He then shows you the journey that they went on to get there, and you see the connections between the subconscious viewing of various things to create the article. So, I don't know, does that challenge your artistic creativity?
No, it doesn't, because it kind of fits it in the sense that the idea here is that we don't necessarily know where our ideas come from. That's the whole point. Now, you've got a very particular case there where someone has set out very deliberately to plant ideas. So the artist doesn't know where they've got from. They've actually been manipulated into having them. Now, we don't like that kind of thing. We don't like being manipulated in that sense. But in a way, you see, that's quite interesting because although it's true that we're not ultimately in control of where our ideas come from, in terms of our own freedom, it's quite important that we don't get turned into the tools of other people. So there's a difference between ideas emerging through just unconscious experience, right? So similarly, had they gone to do that in a normal circumstance, they still would have been taking things into their environment, not knowing what they were absorbing, and at the end of it coming up with something. The process in some ways would have been identical. But when you become the tool of someone else's intentions, that's when it becomes a little bit sinister. What's troubling is not that we don't know where things come from and that we take in things unconsciously. It's only troubling when the feeding has been done with someone else's agenda in mind. And there's huge potential for that. And this is why advertising is arguably extremely pernicious, actually. When I was an undergraduate in Reading, I was waiting to get a bus and I had a bit of time for the bus. I thought I'd go and get a snack because I was feeling a bit peckish. And I walked along the street, and at that stage, a typical snack for me would have been like a, you know, Twix or a Mars bar or something. But I thought, I'll have a banana. So I had a banana. So I went back to the bus stop, started eating my banana. So I was back to where I was before I went to get the snack. You know what's coming, don't you? Opposite me on the bus shelter was an advert. Banana's the perfect snack. I hadn't noticed it. And at that point, I think, we should remain humble. But the point is that because we're so susceptible to unconscious influences, I think we do have to be aware, and we have to make sure society is designed in such a way that it's difficult for people to manipulate those things such that we do ourselves. But, you know, yeah, I'll leave it there.
Okay, thank you. Actually, there's one down the back there.
Could you argue that children have a greater degree of free will because they're less influenced and haven't formed their value system?
Okay, yeah, that's an interesting point. The question's a very valuable one because it points to the extent to which we kind of have more than one idea of freedom. So some people would say animals have more freedom than human beings for similar kind of reasons, actually. Because, you know, animals just are as they are and they're not having to kind of conform to, they don't feel the pressure to conform to fashions and trends and thought police and so forth. They just do what they do. So there's a kind of, you know, my cat has a kind of freedom. In some ways, it's more free than anything else. It does exactly what it wants and it gets exactly what it needs and it doesn't have to do anything to earn them, really, you know. But, you know, I think that kind of freedom isn't the freedom that we ultimately value. And that's why we don't ultimately want our children to remain children forever, right? They do have a kind of freedom. And, you know, from the adult point of view, we can almost envy it because, you know, it's a freedom which is rooted in a kind of ignorance, really. It's the innocence of childhood, isn't it? But I think most of us conclude we don't want to live in that kind of innocence forever. And that becoming an adult and becoming more aware of ourselves and the culture and our responsibilities and so forth, it puts certain pressures on us. But without that, we don't become those properly, fully formed, you know, self-regulating things. I don't know. Maybe some people think, no, it's not good. It'd be better if we all remain children. But that's an issue of value, which you have. In a sense, there's no fact to the matter about this. You could argue about this. Would it be better to remain a child all your life, or would it be better to have that adult maturity with all the complexity that comes with it? I think most of us would choose the latter.
Philosopher and public thinker at large, Julian Baggini, on free will, answering questions after his session at the Sydney Writers' Festival. His book on the subject is titled Freedom Regained. Thanks today to Diane Dean and Joe Wallace. I'm Joe Gelonesi. See you next time in the Philosopher's Zone.